I do so much work, Hyatt, and earn so little. Will you not take care of me?
One January afternoon, Sunil took a bath in an abandoned pit at the concrete mixing plant. Pushing away the algae, he examined his reflection with care. He was a thief now, and Sonu said it showed in his face. Sunil knew what his friend meant. He'd seen a change come over the faces of other boys who turned to stealing, a change security guards recognized in an instant. He decided he still looked the same. Same big childish mouth, wide nose, sunken torso. Same thick hair, sticking up and out now, but about which he had no complaint when he thought about his sister Sunita. Rats had bitten them both while they slept, and the bites had turned into head boils. But she had recently become a baldy, because her boils had erupted with worms. Sonu wanted Sunil to renounce his new line of work, and to that end, had recently slapped his face 4 times, hard. Sunil neither slapped back, nor changed his mind. Sonu was probably the most virtuous boy at Anawadi, but he also had a mother and younger siblings working to supplement the household income. Sunil, unable to feed himself by scavenging, had to consider his airport terrain afresh, and locals who fenced stolen goods were glad to help him. For Sunil's first solo mission, a teenage thief wrangler, himself with a worm-bald sister, provided a bicycle for a high-speed getaway. By morning, the airport fire brigade was stripped of copper faucet valves. The game shed man handed over his cutting tools, and metal supports disappeared beneath dozens of concrete sewer covers. As construction workers prepared a cavernous airport car park for its opening, Sunil set to dismantling bits of it, screw by screw. He was well suited to his work as a new economy micro-saboteur. His climbing ability had been honed on airport road coconut trees. His small size helped deflect suspicion, and he didn't balk at calculated risks like the ones he took when jumping down to the garbage-filled ledge above the river. The only problem was that his hands and legs shook every time he picked up a piece of metal, a nervous tick other thieves found hilarious. One of them, Tofik, had been asking him all month, "Should we go into the Taj tonight?" The Anawadi boys' Taj was not the hotel that the terrorists attacked. Their Taj was Taj Catering Services, a squat building on airport grounds owned by the hotel company. Behind high stone walls topped with rows of barbed wire, meals to be served on flights got made. Recently, Sunil had noticed orange netting and iron scaffolding rising above the walls, an indicator that something was being built inside, and that there might be metal on the ground for the taking. In his day, Kalu had scaled the barbed wire to raid the dumpsters. Sunil cased the Taj for an easier way in, discovering a small hole concealed by brush at the base of one wall. The fact that the hole sat at the end of an unlit gravel lane made a stealing expedition practically compulsory. Sunil kept putting off the mission, though. His fellow thief, Tofik, complained that other boys would discover the hole if they hesitated any longer. But this Taj catering made Sunil think of Kalu and of death, as did the military men in blue berets lately crouching behind bunkers, as did the Sahar police, who seemed to have grown meaner in the months since the terror attacks. Recently, a guard at the Indian oil compound had caught Sunil sneaking around in search of metal and delivered him to an inebriated constable named Savant. At the station, the constable had stomped on his back and beaten him so viciously that another officer apologized to Sunil and brought a blanket to cover him. Given the risks, Sunil wanted to spend more nights watching the Taj guards through the hole, assessing the odds of getting caught. In the meantime, he got money for food by working the 4-story car park near completion by the international terminal. By now, he knew the best way in. Past rows of bright red and yellow barricades, past bulldozers and a generator shrouded at night, past a checkpoint where guards with flashlights were opening car trunks, past an awesome mountain of gravel, past a bitter almond tree whose leaves had reddened, which meant the nuts had gone from sour to sweet, past 2 of the security bunkers. One midnight in January, when he visited the dark garage, he couldn't make out which animals were scurrying underfoot. Rats or bandicoots, possibly, but he'd never encountered them in the car park before. Guards he had often encountered, but tonight he couldn't tell where they were. He moved carefully to a stairwell near an exterior wall made of horizontal steel slats. The slatted wall let in a bit of the blue-white light bathing the international terminal, where travelers were still hugging their families goodbye. Being near the light increased the risk of being seen by a guard, but it allowed for proper surveillance. He was searching for what Anuwadians called German silver, aluminum or electroplate or nickel. Lately, the term was spoken with reverence. The price of German silver had recently dropped from 100 rupees per kilo to 60, but the price for everything else had fallen further. Sunil worked his way up the stairwell, taking care, on each landing, to peer through a small hole in the floor. He supposed that a water pipe would eventually run through the holes, but for now they allowed him to ascertain whether guards were slinking up the stairs behind him. Nepali watchmen scared him most, because they were sort of Chinese, like Bruce Lee. On the third tier, in a corner, were two long strips of aluminum. He darted out to grab them, surprised that some other thief hadn't found them. He thought they might have been parts of a window frame, although the car park didn't have windows. The practical function of the items he stole at the airport didn't matter to his work, but he still wondered. He carried the metal strips up to the roof, where the only German silver he'd ever found was inside a red cabinet marked Fire Hose Box, a flimsy holder for a fire extinguisher, worth little. The roof was also where he was most likely to encounter watchmen, who went there to smoke. Still, he tried to get up to this roof on every visit. At four stories, it was the highest roof he'd ever been on, but what made it exhilarating was the vista of open space, a rarity in the city. The roof had two kinds of spaces, really. One kind was when he stood exactly in the middle and knew that even if his arms were 30 times longer, he'd touch nothing if he spun around. That kind of space would be gone when the lot was open and filled with cars a month from now. The space that would last was the kind he leaned into, over the guardrails. He liked seeing red-tailed Air India planes taking off. He liked the bulbous municipal water tower. He liked the building site of the massive new terminal. He didn't care for the smokestack of Parsiwada Crematorium, where Gullu's body had burned. Better to spot the glowing Hyatt sign and try to pinpoint which of the dark patches beneath it was Anuwadi. Best, though, was watching the rich people moving in and out of the terminal. Other boys who visited this roof liked watching the moving people because they looked so small. For Sunil, seeing the people from above made him feel close to them. He felt free to watch them in a way he couldn't when he was on the ground. There, if he stared, they would see him staring. Every month that passed, he felt less sure of where he belonged among the human traffic in the city below. Once he had believed he was smart and might become something, not a big something like the people who frequented the airport, but a middle something. Being on the roof, even if he had come up to steal things, was a way of not being what he had become in Anuwadi. Enough time passed. He had to get home with his German silver. He carried the aluminum strips down the stairs and, before leaving the building, unzipped his pants and slid the metal through the legs of his underwear. German silver against the skin didn't feel good, but when he tried to carry it outside his underwear, it slipped around. He limped, stiff-legged, past the security checkpoints and the Sahar police station. Soon he was at Anuwadi, curling up to sleep in the back of a lorry. The next afternoon, he used the game parlor man's tools to steal tire locks that the airport parking police clipped onto auto rickshaws. When he returned to the game shed after dark, everyone was talking about a woman who had just tried to hang herself and failed. Her indebted husband had sold their hut, and she didn't want to live on the pavement. Too many Anuwadi females wanted to die, it seemed to Sunil. He felt especially sad about Mina, who had been nice to him. And all for an egg, people said. Abdul contended that what Mina had done was daring. People had called Kallu daring, too. Now the Tamil who owned the game shed said that he, Sunil, was Anuwadi's daring boy. The number one thief! Sunil saw through the guy's words to his motive. The Tamil was trying to bolster his confidence so that he'd do the theft at the Taj and sell him the goods. Sunil didn't have that confidence tonight. On the road outside the shed, his father was careening past, and Abdul was talking animatedly to another boy who wasn't listening. As Abdul talked, he was twisting his neck back and forth, same as the water buffalo standing behind him. Sunil laughed as he walked over. It was the kind of goofy behavior Kalu would have mimicked. Abdul and the buffalo were probably flinging back and forth the same killer mosquitoes. "Do you ever think when you look at someone, when you listen to someone, does that person really have a life?" Abdul was asking the boy who was not listening. He seemed to be in one of the possessions that came over him from time to time, ever since he got locked up at Dongri. "Like that woman who just went to hang herself, or her husband, who probably beat her before she did this. I wonder what kind of life is that," Abdul went on. "I go through tensions just to see it, but it is a life. Even the person who lives like a dog still has a kind of life. Once my mother was beating me, and that thought came to me. I said, 'If what is happening now, you beating me, is to keep happening for the rest of my life, it would be a bad life, but it would be a life, too.' And my mother was so shocked when I said that. She said, 'Don't confuse yourself by thinking about such terrible lives.'" Sunil thought that he, too, had a life. A bad life, certainly, the kind that could be ended as Kalu's had been, and then forgotten, because it made no difference to the people who lived in the Overcity. But something he'd come to realize on the roof, leaning out, thinking about what would happen if he leaned too far, was that a boy's life could still matter to himself. In February, the impatient Tofik beat Sunil up and assumed control of the operation to rob Taj Catering Services. Sunil was relieved to be demoted to one of four soldiers. The boys went through the hole in the stone wall once a week for 3 weeks, acquiring 22 small pieces of iron. One night, when security guards came running, the boys pelted them with stones. Sunil now had enough to eat, plus 10 extra rupees to buy a skull-shaped silver plate earring that he'd seen outside the Andheri train station. He'd always wanted to own something shining. There was more German silver in the car park and in the industrial warehouses over the river. A ladder hoisted from a security kiosk was worth 1,000 rupees divided 5 ways. Weeks passed in which Sunil was mostly not hungry, and in which he was granted a wish for something greater than a silvery earring. At first he didn't believe it, thought it was a trick of shadow and light slant on the wall of his hut. But standing back to back with Sunita, it was confirmed. He was taller. As a thief, Sunil Sharma had finally started to grow. Chapter 14. The Trial. While Abdul's father privately believed that the only Indians who went on trial were those too poor to pay off the police, he had raised his children to respect the Indian courts. Of all the public institutions in the country, these courts seemed to Karam the most willing to defend the rights of Muslims and other minorities. In February, his own trial approaching, he began to follow trials across India in the Urdu papers the way some other Anawadians followed soap operas. Though he disputed many a specific court resolution and understood that some judges were corrupt, his relative faith in the judiciary obtained.
"In the police station, they tell us only to be silent," Karam said to Abdul, who remembered enough not to need telling. "In the courts, though, what we say may get heard."
Karam was still more hopeful when he learned that his case had been assigned to the city's fast-track sessions court. In normal courts, 5 or 8 or 11 years sometimes passed between the declaration of charges and the beginning of a trial. To people without permanent work, the vast majority in India, every court appearance involved a forfeit of daily wages. Long trials were economically ruinous. But by fiat of the central government, the massive case backlogs were now being addressed by 1,400 high-speed courts across the country. In Mumbai, verdicts were flying out of fast-track courts so quickly that the number of pending trials, citywide, had declined by a third in 3 years. Many notorious cases, including organized crime ones, went directly to fast track, since the public was presumably eager to see them resolved. But in addition to the publicized cases, which brought television trucks to the fast track courthouse, were thousands of small, unnewsworthy trials, like the Husseins. A judge named P.M. Chohan had been assigned to decide whether Karam and Kekashan had driven their neighbor to self-immolation. Abdul would have a separate trial in juvenile court at a later date and would not see the inside of Judge Chohan's courtroom. As such, the trial felt to him as if it were happening oceans away, no matter what his sister said about a 60-minute bus and train ride to a South Mumbai neighborhood called Suri. The matter was one of many in his life that he considered out of his hands. He simply counted on Kekashan, a more reliable narrator than his father, to keep him apprised of how worried he should be. The courthouse in Suri had previously been a pharmaceutical company.
"This hardly seems like a court," Kekashan said to her father, concerned on the day the trial began.
No teak banisters, nothing stately. The hallways were clotted with encampments, families of other accused people eating, praying, sleeping, leaning against a greasy tile wall upon which signs threatened fines of 1,200 rupees for spitting. The whole place seemed to lack a resident crew of waste pickers. In the courtroom, empty plastic bottles and cans wreathed the base of the high platform from which Judge Chohan presided.
"This lady judge is strict," a police officer had said. "She does not let the accused go free."
Kekashan saw at once that this Judge Chohan was impatient. Pursing her dark red lips, the judge shouted at her father, who had shown up this first day without a lawyer.
"It's a buddy case, a grave one. Don't delay me. Start it fast. Get it going."
The impatience was structural. Like most fast-track judges, Chohan conducted more than 35 trials simultaneously. A given case wasn't heard beginning to end the way Kekashan had seen on TV serials. Rather, it was chopped into dozens of brief hearings that took place at weekly or fortnightly intervals. On an average day, the judge heard bits of 9 trials, so the accused bench where Kekashan and her father sat under police supervision was a crowded affair. There were men on trial for murder, for armed robbery, and for electricity thieving, many of them shackled. Gautam was the oldest man on the bench, Kekashan the solitary female. Their seats were against the back wall of the courtroom, behind a great assembly of white plastic chairs for witnesses and observers, and 2 tiers of metal desks where a proliferation of clerks, prosecutors, and defenders paged through files. To Kekashan, the witness stand and the judge with the lipstick seemed very far away. At the next lightning-fast hearing, the Husseins' lawyer materialized, and a medical officer from Cooper Morgue testified, falsely, that Fatima had been burned over 95% of her body. Hearing over.
"Now what? What's next?"
asked the judge, pulling out a new file and moving to another case. Another week, a Sahar police officer testified about the conclusion of the station's investigation, that the Husseins had beaten Fatima and driven her to suicide.
"Now what? What's next?"
asked the judge. What came next was the part of the trial the Husseins dreaded. Beginning this March day, and continuing in brief sessions for untold weeks, would be the testimony of neighbors whom the police had chosen to interview from Anuwadi, and whom the prosecution had chosen to make its case. Peculiarly, most of these witnesses had not been on hand for the fight that had preceded the burning. Among them were Fatima's husband and her 2 closest friends. On the accused bench, Kekashan was glad for her burqa, which obscured the fact that she was dripping sweat. She'd contracted jaundice in jail, and a lingering fever had just shot up, which she attributed to her anxiety. She considered her family's behavior on the crucial day to have been ragged and shameful. She wished she hadn't said, during the fight with Fatima, that she would twist off her neighbor's other leg. She wished her father hadn't threatened to beat Fatima up. But ugly words were unlikely to send them to prison. They would go to prison if enough of the supposed witnesses backed Fatima's revised hospital statement to the police about being throttled and beaten. Purnima Pike Rao, special executive officer of the government of Maharashtra, had helped craft that hospital statement after which she told Zerunisa that the accounts of other witnesses would be equally damaging unless the Husseins paid her off. She'd made her second attempt at extortion this morning, right outside the courthouse. The Anawadi witnesses might remember new, devastating details of the night in question, the special executive officer had told Karam. She herself might have to testify about Fatima's dying declaration in such a manner that a guilty verdict was all but guaranteed. The special executive officer didn't want to do it. She wanted to help them.
"But what else can I do?"
she asked, palms up, as always.
"Think again about what might happen. You and your children will go to jail. So what do you suggest?"
"I won't pay," Karam had sputtered. "Already my son and daughter have seen the inside of the jail. The terrible things you threaten have already happened. But we're paying the lawyer, not you, to fix it. The lawyer will make the judge see the truth. And if this judge doesn't see it," he had concluded with bravado, "I will take it all the way to the Supreme Court."
Awaiting the first of their neighbors in a trashed-out courtroom, both father and daughter hoped this belief in the Indian judiciary had a basis in reality. First to the wooden witness stand was one of Fatima's two close confidants, a destitute girl named Priya. Priya was probably the saddest girl in Anawadi, and Kakashin had known her for years. This morning, the two young women had shared an auto rickshaw from the slum to the train station, sitting thigh to dampening thigh, each in her own unhappy bubble. Avoiding Kakashin's eyes, Priya had hugged herself, repeating,
"I will not go. I am not going."
Priya had avoided most people's eyes since the burning.
"Fatima was the only person who knew my heart's pain," she once said.
A tougher girl might have been able to forget her friend's cries for help, her thrashings. But at the stand, as in Anawadi, Priya wore her damage like a slash across the face. It wasn't the kind of damage that turned a girl into a fabulist, though. Trembling, Priya told the prosecutor she hadn't been on the Maidan when the fight occurred, and had seen Fatima only after she'd been burned. Fatima provoked a lot of fights in the slum, Priya allowed to the defender before being dismissed from the stand. Succeeding her in front of the judge was a handsome, articulate man named Dinesh, who loaded luggage at the airport. Kakashin had never spoken to him, but she'd heard rumors that his testimony would be damaging. She felt sicker than ever when she saw him take the stand with a clenched jaw, a livid face. Because he was speaking in Marathi, some minutes passed before Kakashin figured out that his anger was not directed at her family, but at the Sahar police. Shortly after the burning, an officer had recorded a witness statement under Dinesh's name describing the fight. The statement was false, Dinesh told the judge. He'd been at home in another slum lane, hadn't seen the fight, and didn't see why he'd been called as a key prosecution witness. He cared little about the Husseins or whether they ended up in prison. What he cared about was having to forgo a day's income because of an inaccurate police statement. The surprised prosecutor quickly wrapped up his questioning, the hearing came to an end, and Kakashin and her father returned to Anawadi feeling almost giddy. Despite the insinuations of the special executive officer, the first witnesses hadn't lied in order to ruin them. Looking back, Kakashin would remember this afternoon's shock of optimism before the seams of the celebrated fast-track court began to show. By April, the case against the Husseins was poking along in bitty hearings, and Judge P.M. Chohan was annoyed. Her stenographer, adept in only the Marathi language, was hopeless at translating the slum Hindi of the Anawadi witnesses into the English required for the official transcript. Impatient at the translation delays, the judge began telling the stenographer what to write, and so a slum dweller's nuanced replies to the prosecutor's questions became monosyllabic ones, the better to keep the case moving along. At the end of a particularly tedious hearing, the judge rose for lunch and sighed to the prosecutor and defender.
"Ah, fighting over petty, stupid personal things, these women! All that, and it reached such a level they made it a case!"
It was becoming apparent that the outcome of the trial mattered only to the people of Anawadi. For Kakashin and her father, 10 years of incarceration were at stake. But as the weeks progressed, they found it impossible to understand what was being said for or against them in the front of the courtroom. The windows had been opened on account of the April heat, so instead of hearing the testimony upon which their liberty depended, they heard the cacophony of an industrial road.
Car horns, train horns, throttling engines, the beep-beep of trucks reversing. This outside noise seemed to be sucked in by the ceiling fan, churned and flung outward by its metal blades. Hearing over, next hearing.
Now something had gone wrong with the fan, and its whirring had become a loud clatter. What was the policeman telling the judge? What was the judge telling the prosecutor? The prosecutor had an orange comb-over, stiff with hairspray, and when he nodded vigorously, one clump of hair came loose and traveled upward. More vigorous nodding, and it was straight in the air, like a finger pointing to the heavens. Hearing over. Come back in a week. Kakashin stopped leaning forward, started sagging in her seat. She was so poised the day Fatima's husband took the stand.
A few months back, Fatima's husband, Abdul Sheikh, had brought his daughters to the Hussein home for Eid, the holiest day of the Muslim year. Young Abdul had dejugulated a goat on the Maidan, and old Abdul had worked with him shoulder to shoulder, stripping back the muscle to mine the meat for the feast. Same as they'd always done at Eid. A good goat this year, a good time. But the trial was a matter of honor for Fatima's husband, just as it was for the Husseins. The old garbage sorter had been able to hear more than the Husseins could from his seat in the middle of the courtroom. As the trial progressed, he realized that Fatima's deathbed account of a beating and a throttling was being undermined. Witnesses kept saying the fight had been one of hot words. Abdul Sheikh was disturbed by this contradiction of the first and last official statement of his wife. He and Fatima had not been happy after the first warm year. They'd fought regularly about her lovers, the force with which she'd beat the children, the force with which he beat her when drunk. He didn't have it in him to prettify their history. But day in and day out since Fatima's death, he had had to live beside the Husseins, hearing Zerunisa singing to her daughters, hearing Mirchi making everyone laugh. Fatima's suicide had thieved him of the chance, however remote, of finding peace with his wife and giving his beloved daughters a happy home. He wanted to blame someone other than his wife for this loss of future possibility. He wanted the judge to convict the Husseins. The problem was that he wasn't sure what the Husseins had or hadn't done to Fatima, and had said so in his original statement to the police. He'd been at work, arriving home only to see his wife grotesquely injured. His daughters, underfoot during the fight, had told him that no one had hit anyone. But where did that leave those girls? He didn't want them to grow up knowing that their mother had burned herself, lied, and died. His daughters were back at Anawadi now. He'd removed them from Sister Paulette's care upon finding bruises on their arms and legs. They'd been elated to leave.
"Always we had to say thank you, Jesus, to a picture of a white man," his younger daughter said. "It was so boring."
Since coming home, they hadn't once asked about their mother, but Nuri, who'd seen the burning through the window, had changed. She'd stand in the road as if she wanted the oncoming cars to hit her, and had developed a nervous habit of chewing her headscarf. Today, though, she'd been excited to take the train across the city to the courthouse, and especially enthusiastic about the television camera set up outside.
"Some big trial must be happening today," Abdul Sheikh had told his daughters, who'd run in front of one camera to smile and wave.
Other Anawadians said the younger daughter, Hina, smiled just like her mother. Abdul Sheikh thought this was correct, though he didn't have a great mental reserve of Fatima smiles to reflect on.
"Will they show us on TV now?"
Nuri had asked as the three of them went through a low metal security gate. Turning to answer, Abdul Sheikh banged his head hard on the gate. He still felt dazed an hour later, standing in the wooden witness box. In his right hand, he clutched a creased plastic bag containing his wife's death certificate, two photos of her dressed nicely, the pink outfit in the blue, and the government document about her disability that had secured her metal crutches, free of charge. These remainders of her presence stank of mildew and contained words he couldn't read, but he wanted them in his hands as he gave the testimony he hoped would put the Husseins in prison. The judge looked at him kindly while swearing him in, but when the prosecutor cleared his throat, Abdul Sheikh's knees buckled. He had to grab the stand to stay upright. He had never been in such a place, talking to such intimidating people. At the most basic questions of the prosecutor, a man he understood to be on his side, he grew flustered.
"Who do you live with?"
the prosecutor asked. "His wife," he said, as if she were not dead. To the next question, he insisted he was 35 years old. He got his daughter's names right, but his home address eluded him. He wasn't sure where he was supposed to look when he answered. Should he look at the judge, who was considering him placidly from her perch high above the stand, or at the prosecutor, who stood opposite him on his level? When he looked at the defense lawyer, he became still more confused, for the defender was grinning at the judge for no discernible reason. He decided to look only at the judge. To her, he got out his account of finding Fatima at home and taking her to the hospital.
"Was your wife in a condition to speak to you that night?"
This was the first crucial question that Abdul Sheikh had to answer. He had to rally, and did.
"Yes, she could speak," he said forcefully.
He appeared relieved that the words came out right.
"What did your wife tell you on the way to Cooper Hospital?"
"She told me they called her a prostitute and would take her other leg," he began.
This was what he told the police in his original statement 9 months earlier, but it did not sound awful enough in this courtroom. Just ordinary Annawadi words. After a long pause, he continued.
"She told me they beat her."
Another long pause, thinking. Then he said,
"She told me that they held her by the neck and beat her with a big stone."
There, the words of a dying woman that he hoped might turn around the case. The prosecutor seemed delighted, and the Sahar policemen in attendance were happy too. As the Husseins' mop-haired, pinstriped defender began the cross-examination, Abdul Sheikh's composure continued to grow. No, his wife had not been depressed after their daughter Medina drowned in a pail. No, his wife hadn't poured kerosene on herself twice before. By the time he staggered off the stand and collapsed into a white plastic chair, he believed he had avenged his children's loss.
"Now what? What next?"
said Judge Chauhan, by way of calling the final Annawadi witness to the stand. Cynthia Ali, Fatima's best friend, had resented the Husseins ever since her husband's garbage business went under. Late on the night of the burning, as Abdul hid in his storeroom, she'd stood in the Maidan trying to convince her neighbors to march to the police station and demand the arrest of the whole Hussein family. Although Cynthia hadn't seen the fight between Fatima and the Husseins, the following day she had given the police a witness statement to the contrary. Then, through the brothel keeper's wife, she had informed the Husseins that her testimony would send them to jail unless they paid her 20,000 rupees before she took the stand. The Husseins, having refused to pay, had been bracing for her vengeance for months.
"I feel as if I'm going crazy,"
Zerunisa had said to Abdul the previous day as they waited for scavengers at the scales. She had a wild look in her eyes that he hadn't seen since she'd stood at the window of the Sahar police station's unofficial cell.
"After lying in court, what honor will she have?" Zerunisa asked. "If you lose your honor, how can you show your face in Annawadi?"
Abdul found his mother's question absurd. Cynthia had washed her hair for her court date and put on her best sari, purple, with a blue and gold border. There was nothing to be done about the teeth. In recent days, she'd envisioned her testimony as a decisive occasion, laying her anticipated performance against climactic trial scenes in Hindi movies. It had been painful to watch the Husseins' income grow as her family's foundered. She thought that Zerunisa had been lucky, having a sorting machine like Abdul come out of her body. But Zerunisa acted as if she'd been smart. Moreover, Zerunisa gossiped about how Cynthia, a Christian, had once worked in an exotic dance bar, a chapter of Cynthia's life long closed. Lately, she called herself a social worker and was trying to get into the anti-poverty business, just like Asha. There was a lot of government and international money going around. When Judge Chauhan called her forward, she stood pole straight, confidently announcing her name and the new profession of social work. Only when the prosecutor began asking questions did her head start to cock. This prosecutor was nothing like the prosecutors in the movies. He wasn't looking at her intently, despite her spectacular sari. He seemed as bored by the trial as the judge. Cynthia's brows knitted together. She felt the prosecutor was rushing her. Didn't the judge want to hear the details of the fight she was pretending to have seen? Her story about how she'd helped break down the door to save her smoldering friend. She'd barely warmed up when the prosecutor's questions stopped coming, and the Husseins' private defender rose for the cross-examination. This guy did seem like a lawyer in the films. Uncharacteristically alert in the face of a dubious witness, the last witness of a tedious trial, he sprang. Yes, she admitted to his questioning. Her family business had failed, as the Husseins had prospered. Yes, she said, she lived in a hut some distance from the Husseins, in another slum lane. Yes, her home was far from where the fighting had taken place. Yes, she had been home chopping vegetables for dinner. So how could you have seen what happened? The defender wanted to know.
But I saw it, she insisted, frowning. She was my neighbor.
I don't think so, the defender said. You said earlier that you saw the fight, but that wasn't true. You lied. The judge repeated for her inept stenographer a nonsensical combination of this question and answer.
I lied and I saw the fight.
Cynthia's eyes went wide. Cynthia's son had studied English in a Catholic school, and she'd picked up a little as she helped him study. What she understood was that the judge had told the stenographer to write that she had admitted she was a liar. She wanted a correction. She wanted time to think, regroup.
Wait!
She cried so loudly that Kakashin and her father heard her over the din of the street. But this was fast-track court. A nothing case in fast-track court. No one was going to wait. Her witness services were no longer required. Judge Chohan was calling another case. A policeman was gesturing toward the door. But how could she leave the stand having been misunderstood? How could she get this false iteration of her own false words out of the stenographer's computer? She shook with anger. But at whom? The judge? The lawyers? The justice system? She decided to blame the Husseins, hunched on the accused bench in the back.
I will show you!
She yelled as she left the courtroom, raising her fist in high, filmy style. But her performance was over, and no one was filming. The misconstrued witnesses and the mystified accused all got on the same train to return to their regular, contentious lives in Anuwadi, where they would stew about what they thought had happened but couldn't know for sure. Closing arguments were to come in 2 weeks. Chapter 15. Ice. One afternoon, Abdul, Mirchi, and their parents stood, hands behind backs, contemplating a motley cachet of garbage in the storeroom. They tried to forestall a trip to the recycling plants because prices were so low, but now they had no choice. They had sold the storeroom to pay for the lawyer. Although Abdul had been working maniacally on the days he didn't have to report to Dongri, he was making little money. The Sahar police had effectively put the Husseins out of business. As the trial proceeded, the whole family had tried to follow the virtuous path of Abdul's teacher at Dongri, not buying anything that might have been stolen. Although this decision reduced the family income by 15%, it didn't decrease the attention of the police. Officers came to demand money every day now,
licking at us like dogs, sucking what is left of our blood,
Zerunisa cried one afternoon. Unable to accuse the family of possessing hot goods, the officers threatened to arrest Abdul for sorting his garbage on the Maidan. A usurpation of public space, a crime against Anuwadian's quality of life. The officers hinted that a new charge might be used to show the judge that the family had a pattern of criminality. So Zerunisa paid bribe after bribe as her husband searched for a storeroom in another police district where officers might not know about the court case. Karam tried to be optimistic about what they would make by selling off the last of their recyclables.
There must be 5 kilos of German silver here, he said. Maybe 2 kilos of copper.
Bullshit, snapped Zerunisa. It is much less than that. Like father, like son, Mirchi is like you. Doesn't want to work, only wants to eat. Both of you want everything for free.
Mirchi winced. Growing up, he'd been the first to call himself lazy. He liked to show his friends a bleached-out photo of Abdul and himself as toddlers.
See how Abdul is moving while I am sitting? It was like that even then.
But the family catastrophe had changed him.
he'd become a fast, competent garbage sorter and taken every other job he could find. He'd worked construction with his best friend, Rahul, finishing two swimming pools in a new boutique hotel on Airport Road. Then he scored the temp work of his dreams, setting up for parties at the Intercontinental Hotel. A subcontractor had liked the looks of him and handed him a clip-on bow tie and a uniform coat. The coat's cloth was as black and glossy as a crow's wing. His mother had grown silent when she touched it. At the end of the work week, though, the subcontractor reclaimed the beautiful coat and paid him only a fifth of what he'd been promised. When Mirchi traveled across the city to the man's office to collect the remainder, security guards turned him away. His next temp job was at Sky Gourmet, which made meals served on airplanes. Arriving at work, Mirchi stood under a blower that blasted the city dirt from his body, then loaded food onto pallets inside a cavernous freezer. It was miserable labor, carrying heavy containers when he was too cold to manage his limbs. Ice formed inside his runny nose, and when his flesh touched metal, it stuck. Still, he made 200 rupees a day, until management cut back the temp staff. Many businesses dependent on the airport were downsizing as the effects of the terror attacks and the recession persisted. Asha's political party, Shiv Sena, had been protesting these cuts, sometimes violently. After layoffs at the Intercontinental, a Shiv Sena gang smashed up its elegant lobby, demanding more work for the Maharashtrians, a rampage of which Rahul was one beneficiary. He secured a 6-month stint cleaning air conditioning ducts. Mirchi was happy for Rahul, and only a little resentful that his own parents' best connections were with scavengers.
"There's this guy who counts cars in a parking lot, and he said he saw the talent in me," Mirchi reported one evening at home, breathless in his hope that his new contact might lead to steady work.
But there were millions of other bright, likable, unskilled young men in the city. As the Husseins waited for closing arguments in their case, the rest of Mumbai began following another fast-track trial. The lone surviving gunman of the terror attack, a 21-year-old Pakistani named Ajmal Kasab, had his hearings in a dedicated high-security courtroom at Arthur Road Jail. Abdul's father said that what Kasab had done was wrong, that the Quran didn't entitle Muslims to kill innocent civilians, some of whom had also been Muslim. Still, Kasab seemed lucky to Abdul. "They will probably beat him lots in the jail," Abdul said one day. "But at least Kasab knows in his heart that he did what they said he did." That had to be less stressful than being beaten when you were innocent. The popular rage about Kasab didn't seem to transfer to other Muslims in Mumbai, Abdul was relieved to find on the 3 days a week he traveled by train to Dongri. In the clammy, crowded train cars, he was no one's proxy. The Hindus were just going where they had to go, as he was. Like him, they were coughing, eating lunch, looking out windows at billboards on which Bollywood heroes hawked cement and Coca-Cola. They were bent protectively over prized documents and prized plastic bags like his own, which said, "Take a break, have a Kit Kat." It was all as it had been, which was hopeful. Mumbai's wealthy were also hopeful in the months after the terrorist attacks. Many had begun to engage in politics for the first time, intent on bringing about government reform. Rich Indians typically tried to work around a dysfunctional government. Private security was hired, city water was filtered, private school tuitions were paid. Such choices had evolved over the years into a principle: the best government is the one that gets out of the way. The attacks on the Taj and the Oberoi, in which executives and socialites died, had served as a blunt correction. The wealthy now saw that their security could not be requisitioned privately. They were dependent on the same public safety system that ill-served the poor. 10 young men had terrorized one of the world's biggest cities for 3 days, a fact that had something to do with the ingenuity of a multi-pronged plot, but perhaps also to do with government agencies that had been operating as private market stalls, not as public guardians. The crisis response units of the Mumbai police lacked arms. Officers in the train station didn't know how to use their weapons and ran and hid as two terrorists killed more than 50 travelers. Other officers, called to rescue inhabitants of a besieged maternity hospital, stayed put at police headquarters, 4 blocks away. Ambulances failed to respond to the wounded, Military commandos took 8 hours to reach the heart of the financial capital, a journey that involved an inconveniently parked jet, a stop to refuel, and a long bus ride from the Mumbai airport. By the time the commandos arrived in South Mumbai, the killings were all but over. Parliamentary elections would be held at the end of April, and middle and upper-class people, especially young people, were registering to vote in record numbers. Affluent, educated candidates were coming forward with platforms of radical change, accountability, transparency, e-governance. While independent India had been founded by high-born, well-educated men, by the 21st century, few such types stood for elections, or voted in them, since the wealthy had extra-democratic means of securing their social and economic interests. Across India, poor people were the ones who took the vote seriously. It was the only real power they had. Another garbage trader had set up shop at Annawadi, filling the niche created by the demise of the Hussein's business. Abdul now spent his days in a tiny rented storage shed at the edge of the Sakinaka slums. His efforts at trading came to little. The Sakinaka scavengers had pre-existing allegiances. But sitting idly in the doorway of the new shed, looking out over an alien Maidan, Abdul found that he felt light. Annawadi tragedies did not rank here. No one knew of Fatima, or of his family's trial, or of Kallu's death, or that Sanjay and Meena had eaten rat poison. Afternoons, a man turned a small Ferris wheel with a hand crank, and children took rides for a rupee. The police came to take bribes from other businesses, but left him alone, probably because any fool could tell he wasn't making money. He had almost as much time to think as he'd had at Dongri, and maybe because of the boiling April sun, he thought about water and ice. Water and ice were made of the same thing. He thought most people were made of the same thing, too. He himself was probably little different, constitutionally, from the cynical, corrupt people around him. The police officers, and the special executive officer, and the morgue doctor who fixed Kallu's death. If he had to sort all humanity by its material essence, he thought he would probably end up with a single gigantic pile. But here was the interesting thing. Ice was distinct from, and in his view, better than, what it was made of. He wanted to be better than what he was made of. In Mumbai's dirty water, he wanted to be ice. He wanted to have ideals. For self-interested reasons, one of the ideals he most wanted to have was a belief in the possibility of justice. It wasn't easy to believe just now. The lawyer for Kakashan and Karam had been confident about exoneration after Cynthia's ragged performance as a prosecution witness. But just before closing arguments, Judge Chauhan had been transferred to a court on the other side of the state. A new judge would have to be appointed and, using the flawed court transcript, try to pick up where the first judge had left off. The Husseins were crushed, a fact not lost on the special executive officer with the gold-rimmed spectacles. She came for a third time to try to extort payment from them, this time accompanied by Fatima's husband. The new judge was severe and likely to find the Husseins guilty, the special executive officer said. Fortunately, Fatima's husband was willing to take back the case. He would cancel his testimony and the testimony of his late wife, upon which the trial would shut down. The price for ending the trial would be 2 lakhs, more than $4,000. The special executive officer seemed to be banking on the ignorance of slum dwellers, that the Husseins wouldn't understand that the case against them was a criminal one, brought by the state of Maharashtra, and that Fatima's husband didn't have the power to call it off, no matter how much the Husseins paid. Before telling the woman off, Abdul's father checked his facts with his lawyer. He wanted to make sure that what he'd gleaned about legal process from reading Urdu newspapers was correct. It was. Finally, a small triumph of information over corruption. Every country has its myths, and one that successful Indians like to indulge was a romance of instability and adaptation. The idea that their country's rapid rise derived in part from the chaotic unpredictability of daily life. In America and Europe, it was said, people know what is going to happen when they turn on the water tap or flick the light switch. In India, a land of few safe assumptions, Chronic uncertainty was said to have helped produce a nation of quick-witted, creative problem-solvers. Among the poor, there was no doubt that instability fostered ingenuity. But over time, the lack of a link between effort and result could become debilitating.
"We try so many things," as one Anawadi girl put it, "but the world doesn't move in our favor."
3 days a week, going through the child-sized security gate at Dongri, Abdul scanned the courtyard for the master. He wanted to tell him about the government official who had tried to trick his parents, and about how well the trial had been going until the female judge was sent away, and how his Anawadi business had been undone by the police. Abdul had told so many lies about the master back at Anawadi that he started to believe the man actually cared how he was faring. Abdul didn't find the master, though. After signing his name in a register, he returned to the street, wondering how he could delay going back to a shed in Sakinaka where he was failing to make his family's living. One day, trying to recover his energy, he walked an hour from the juvenile jail to Haji Ali, the city's storied Muslim gathering place. "I won't go long," he had promised his mother, "just long enough to fill my heart." The mosque and tomb of Haji Ali sat on an islet in the Arabian Sea, connected to the mainland by a rocky promontory. Salty gusts turned the burqas in front of Abdul into hundreds of black balloons, floating slowly down the promontory toward the glittering dome of the mosque. On either side of him, merchants with fold-up tables were selling paste jewelry and plastic water guns. Above him, the sky was battling gull wings. It was beautiful, like he was walking into an Urdu calendar. Then he registered what no calendar ever showed. The narrow road to Haji Ali was lined with one legs. No legs, too. Stretching before him for hundreds of yards were disabled beggars, prostrate, keening and tearing their clothes. It was like a mad multiplication of Fatimas. He departed Haji Ali in haste. The confusion he felt wasn't going to be addressed by feasting his eyes on something lofty. It could be eased only by a court deciding that he hadn't attacked a disabled woman, throttled her, and driven her to a violent suicide. Abdul could control many of his desires, but not this one. He wanted to be recognized as better than the dirty water in which he lived. He wanted a verdict of ice. Chapter 16. Black and White. Asha had conceived of 100 escape routes from Anawadi, but in the first months of 2009, those paths kept dead-ending, and she began to feel scooped out and sad. Possibly an electrical shock was to blame for disrupting her normal, optimistic mental circuits. Possibly Mr. Cumblay had left a curse when he finally died for want of a heart valve. For shortly after his cremation, his pretty widow, in debt to a loan shark, stole one of Asha's most useful male companions. It was hardly the first time Asha had been dismissed by a man without warning. In earlier times, though, she'd managed to seal the disappointment in some tidy interior compartment and bustle forth in pursuit of something new. The questions had even entertained her. What to try, whom to try next? But now, such questions merely illuminated the fact that her previous answers had been wrong. Gold pots flaked away, revealing mud pots. Asha's slavish attention to corporator Subhash Savant was the biggest mud pot. Shortly after her spectacular Navratri, a judge had expelled her political patron from office for pretending to be low caste. But her list of disappointments was long. The grocery store for which she'd received a government loan and which she'd hoped her husband could run from the hut. The tedious, still unremunerative slumlording. The idea of Manju as insurance agent to the Mumbai elite. The idea of Manju as a profit center bride. The windfall that was supposed to have come from securing flats for Sahar police officers to conduct their side businesses. Other schemes that had sucked up months before sputtering out. The parliamentary elections were closing in, and she was supposed to be leafleting the slums. Shiv Sena people called 5 times a day to remind her. The newly installed corporator from the Congress Party also called. To win the slum dwellers' affection, he had installed elegant paving stones on the Maidan, plus a black marble monument to the Congress Party. Now he needed an Asha. Her power at Anawadi had transcended party affiliation. But Asha was as reluctant to pledge allegiance to another politician as she was to Leaflet. She wanted to stay inside and cry. Coming home from kindergarten, she wrapped herself in a blanket and murmured a Marathi poem she had copied from a bulletin board in Mankurd. What you don't want is always going to be with you. What you want is never going to be with you. Where you don't want to go, you have to go. And the moment you think you're going to live more, you're going to